This week on Decentralized, transhumanism and fragility, and special guests Devin Reed and Ryan Taylor of Project Alexandria.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm Jazz Ferguson.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralized.
Eric, we've had several conversations lately in which I've been very depressed about the future of technology and the future of humanity. And it's no thanks to you, or it's all thanks to you, really, because I don't know if there's any more techno-despairing person about the future of humanity, AI, and technology than you. What started you on that path, man?
I don't think I'm despairing. I just think that I'm looking at things honestly and trying to wrestle with some very, very deep issues, right? So I've historically I've been a transhumanist, and a transhumanist is this person that believes that we can sort of perpetually extend our lives, sort of as medicine and science and technology as a greater whole can get better. We can extend our biological lives, gene therapy, just medicine alone, expanding into gene therapy, and just sort of figuring out exactly how does life actually function. And there's been a lot of progress made, certainly in the past few years towards this, like understanding how, you know, RNA and DNA replicate, that the telomere shortening process sort of sets a lifespan for individual cells, or the number of times that they can replicate, which controls the upper limit of human life, and ultimately to this digital consciousness idea that, you know, your brain and your mentality can be transferred to a machine at some point, right? That we could somehow emulate eventually down to the atomic level, maybe, or even below that, subatomic level, like what exactly is going on in a brain. And if we can do that, does that mean that we can emulate consciousness in the same way that we can emulate emulate entire computers today? I think the answer has always been yes. Now, the sort of counterbalance for that is like this idea is... The counterbalance is, okay, so the singularity is happening. If we can start emulating human brains, right, if we can start emulating consciousness, then we can bring about this idea of what's called a strong AI. And a strong AI is one that is self-aware, highly intelligent, it's capable of self-modification, and it's this concept that, well, if that's possible, and you can emulate, let's say, in just perfectly real time, right? Let's just say it works exactly at the same speed as a human, but you can do it in parallel, right? You can do it, you know, 100 times over with the same brain. You can do it, you know, 1,000 times over with the same brain. Then very quickly, once that even just becomes barely minimum possible, you get this massive acceleration in ability to emulate consciousness. This idea that an artificial intelligence, an AI, will very quickly become much smarter than we are. And this is a scary concept, right? I mean, it's a non-organic being, or maybe it ends up being organic. We don't know. And what does that mean for us and our humanity? What does that mean for, you know, what we've known for, you know, tens of thousands of years as, you know, as Homo sapiens? What does that mean for our emotion and our human experience about being born, living a life with surrounded by friends and family and experiencing things, accomplishments, and then the waning of life towards death? Does life lose meaning if we become transhuman, if we, you know, eliminate the possibility of death? Or what happens when we become extinct, even when, say, an AI becomes significantly better than us and causes us to completely go extinct? These are two separate paths, and I think that we have to look at them very realistically. The context for which of transhumanism is like this idea that you know, on the grand scale of things, the scale of the universe as we know it today, life on Earth alone is just a flash in the pan. Like this fact that, you know, we think the universe is, you know, many billion years old, like 10 or 13 billion years old, and the Earth alone is like only like 6 or 7 billion, and you know, humans have only been around for what, like maybe 20,000 years of that, right? Life on Earth has only been around for like 300 or 400 million years. Like, that's a tiny speck. And what happens when, you know, when we die? We think about our humanity as like, you know, our accomplishments. How will people remember us, right? Like, and that's the only thing that we can leave a lasting impact. And a lot of people place a lot of value and faith in that. But the reality is, like, well, even your accomplishments, it's very unlikely that your accomplishments will span beyond, you know, a very short period of time in human lifespan, and a couple of generations in most cases, and certainly only in very rare cases does it expand more than 100 or so years, and maybe even 1,000 if you're, you know, Alexander the Great or a notorious thinker, and you've really made some accomplishments. So this idea is like, well, you know, can we leave a mark that's more lasting than that? Is there going to be an asteroid that comes out of space and just completely obliterates all life on Earth? Historically speaking, that's extremely likely, right? Like, there's asteroids everywhere. There's all sorts of, neutrino pulses that are just, like, blasting. The universe is a very scary place. There's tons of stuff that's happened out there. We could just be vanished in an instant. So how do we actually figure out a way to be more meaningful? And what is that? And if we do figure out a way to become more meaningful, maybe even eventually explore the stars and conquer the universe, right? Like that's the ultimate idea, at least for me. I don't know how to call it optimism or not, or pessimism, but it's just a very interesting conversation to me. I don't know what things will be, but I love sort of exploring that mentally.
Well, it's a huge topic and like a very philosophical one too. So. Listeners, have some empathy with me right now. I'm sure you're just as confused and just as sort of like wowed by how big this question is, because this is a very big one. It's something, you know, we can look at the survival aspects of it, we can look at, you know, sort of the singularity aspects of it, but just to narrow it down and focus on something, you know, something you identified, there's a question lingering, whether we're talking about technology or not, of how we leave an impact on the world and how we're remembered, and something that's always kind of like tugged at me a little bit is this conflict we see between an increasingly advanced society and an increasingly digitized one, that even as we become so advanced and become, you know, relatively advanced and capable of doing really great things, our technology becomes far less visible, right? So we see the pyramids of the Egyptians, which have lasted for, you know, 5,000 years plus. And, of course, they're not technology. In fact, they're just sort of stupid statues to dead people, to dead rulers. But we remember those. We see those as great landmarks of civilization. It's frustrating to me that we won't be able to see like something like Bitcoin, you know, assuming an asteroid does come and wipes us all out, or civilization collapses for some reason, which I think is, in that a kind of Egyptian or Roman scenario, is probably pretty unlikely now. But assuming we lose everything, how will people remember what we're building now, the decentralized technologies we're building now, the digital content we're producing? So much of our creativity is not in the form of like bricks and mortar, like pyramids. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that. I mean, what are some ways we can kind of secure that legacy of progress we've made for future generations in such a way that it lasts through natural disasters, even through human-made ones? And that's for both of you.
Well, in a way, we've already done that, right? We've been sending out radio waves into the universe for the past, you know, 100 years or so. Those are going to be traveling for a very, very, very long time. So, you know, there could be other alien races and other galaxies that will, you know, in a few 100 billion years, will catch a little bit of, you know, I Love Lucy or something.
It's so awesome. And it's frustrating that we're not a star, so we won't be a supernova. Basically, we won't have our starlight viewed by other civilizations. But that's a really interesting insight. I like that.
I mean, it's true, right? But, I mean, radio waves are transient, too. And at some point, like, you start to expand your scope and your perspective, and you think, like, once the radio wave passes, it's gone. So if nobody's listening or recording to it, it's gone. It's not gonna pass you again. Maybe there's like rebroadcasters or something. But then you really zoom out and you keep looking further and further in time and distance. And we don't know the cosmographic, you know, principles of this necessarily. But I mean, there's a lot of theories that, you know, even the universe has heat death, right? Like either we're gonna expand infinitely out into nothingness, or we're going to, you know, come into a big crunch at some point and, you know, everything that we knew will be gone anyways. It's sort of nihilist, right? Like this idea that, you know, it's all meaningless anyways. But I mean, then you zoom back in and you look at, you know, societies in our history, in Earth's history, and you take a look at things like like in Egypt, right? Like that was a massive, huge society, right? They had, you know, rulers and slaves and massive structures that we still don't fully understand how they constructed them with their technology. Like that's, and we're thinking about them thousands and thousands of years later. Well, there was things that were lost back then, right? And you know, we're going to have a guest that shares the same namesake on later. But the Library of Alexandria always strikes me as something that's like something that had a massive amount of value that we still weep for its loss in society today. And it was this in the city of Alexandria in Egypt. There was the royal library, right, where all of the content and knowledge and books and scrolls, right, at the time. Was stored. The greatest philosophers and people who really thought at a very highbrow level, you know, that's where all of these documents from all around the known world were stored. And it was burned to the ground. Everything there is just completely lost, right? So this aggregation, this great effort to sort of organize and aggregate was completely wiped away, whether maliciously or by accident, still remains in debate, I think. I think it was actually actively burned down like once or twice at this point. And then one of the times was supposedly an accident. I don't know, but it's a shame. And it strikes me like there's, you know, I don't know if you guys have seen like ISIS a couple of months ago, I think, like they went in and destroyed those statues, right? They went in like literally tore down statues. Those are works of art that somebody tried to leave a permanent mark on the world, or at least a long-lasting mark, that were destroyed. And this idea of like radio waves and digital storage of things is something we will talk about later, but there has to be some mechanism by which we eliminate single points of failure, and this speaks really deeply to the essence of this show, which is the decentralization movement. If you have something that is centralized, that is a single point, you're making this big effort to put all your energy into one thing and just saying, hey, this is going to be a monument to remember this time or this battle or this idea or whatever it may be, then that's centralized. That's a single point of failure. All someone has to do is, you know, light a match and burn down your library, or, you know, bring in a bulldozer and topple your monument, or crush your thing to stone. Like, we have to, the only solution here is going to be able to be a striped solution where there's multiple copies. There has to be many copies. The more copies, the better. The more more places that you can store this content, the better, right? Because then it doesn't matter who gets arrested or who gets thrown in jail or whose servers get taken down. This content will still be available for those who want to consume it, and I think that's something really important. I think that's why maybe even, you know, Bitcoin and Alexandria and all of these technology projects that aim to sort of decentralize things resonate so well with me, is because at a deeper level, I want to aim beyond just my personal legacy. I want to aim beyond just, you know, being remembered for a couple hundred years. I want to make an impact on society that lasts, you know, forever. I want, like, that's like the grandest of ideas that you could have, I suppose. And maybe I'm unique in this matter, I don't know. But I would like to think that people want to be remembered, and they've not just abandoned this idea that, you know, they have a greater potential than just, you know, the shortest of their life, the existence of their lifespan, and making a small impact. And maybe I also am just sort of, you know, naive and, you know, too hopeful, and maybe I should focus on, you know, my personal life and just relinquish myself to just that. And maybe that's my personal struggle and tragedy, perhaps. I don't know.
That's another very Zen philosophical question, and we're pondering a lot of those in this episode. That's part of the value you get from listening to our show, actually. But that's really, it's an interesting question. It's something you observed, in, I think in the course of that, was something important to observe, I think, which is that, you know, this idea of being wiped out by an AI or by an asteroid, if that does happen, it's pretty far out. Every day, though, we see acts of destruction happening by violent people, by people who are bent on power. So we really do need practical solutions to that. And you're right, the blockchain and these other technologies that are kind of rising around it, whether decentralized, distributed, everything in between, they're doing a lot to really secure that for people. Or just think older tech like radio. I mean, there's a plethora of things. And I think the key to all of these is that they're things that gain from disorder, which kind of leads me to another concept which I think is really closely tied to decentralization, or can be closely tied to its success, which is the idea of anti-fragility. That's fragility with an anti in front of it. And this is sort of a newer concept, is kind of created by the author of a book called Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain From Disorder, and the author is Nassim Nicholas Taleb. He is a Lebanese scholar, Lebanese-American scholar, who wrote on this concept of basically... we have divided things in sort of in our minds between robust things, things that withstand chaos, and fragile things, things that suffer from chaos. And of course, very centralized points of failure are very fragile things. Robust things are great, but there's something even better, which is the anti-fragile things that actually like they thrive off of chaos. So I think that would make Eric and Chaz here pretty anti-fragile people. And it's a really fascinating concept. I think it's something which we should definitely look at. With their technologies, how can we apply this? And there are some parallels in the natural world. Just for example, there's this idea of hormesis, and a lot of the anxious practices actually, that small amounts of poison ingested over a longer period of time would actually build up the body's strength to it. Exercises like this, when you wear your body out or really work it very hard, you're actually gaining strength over time. So I think the key for any technologist now, anyone looking to the future, will be saying, how can we build technologies that actually gain from chaos, gain from disorder, or something that will be stronger after governments try to, you know, mess with it or after terrorists try to destroy it? And I think a big part of that will be building open source technologies and decentralized technologies. But do you see, I guess, going to Chaz, do you see anything out there like this that you think mirrors kind of this general idea of anti-fragility, maybe besides more obvious examples like Bitcoin?
Yeah, I think, really any decentralized technology would, because centralized technologies are fragile, and when compared to a decentralized technology, the decentralized technology will thrive just because of that, the fact that it's decentralized.
Yeah, and to sort of extend on that, it's like if you can build a system where there's an incentive, like not an incentive mechanism per se, but a value that's exchanged in some way, where a natural market, right? And I think that's what a decentralized system becomes very quickly, is a sort of market for either data or information, that because there is chaos, because there's like this unexpected joining and disjoining of nodes, there is an incentive for aggregation and redistribution of content so that as a sum, the system works better. As a sum, there's a natural flow, and there is nothing that changes, nothing that, stays static or constant. And this is, I really liked your example there about working out, right? And lifting weights constantly, what you're doing is you're tearing the muscle fibers, right? You're exercising your heart to pump blood really hard to get oxygen into your system and carbon dioxide out, right? And when you do that and you give it time to rest and rejuvenate, it comes back just a little bit stronger. You do this on a repeated scale, and there's actually a whole field of exercise science that says, do unexpected things. Never, don't do the same workout over and over. Just like fool your body into thinking that it's always under pressure, and your body will naturally react because it is a complex system. It's a system of balances that fights back against resistance naturally in many different ways. So keep it constantly guessing, and it will become a stronger thing as a whole, right? Like you start to think about this from the physical perspective, and then if you just take that exact same model and apply it to a technology, right, then you can very quickly build an AI that just sort of naturally adapts to pressures and ultimately kills us all, right? Like, I mean, that's what I'm saying, is like this model is exactly the right model, and anti-fragility is probably just a convenient name for it. This when you build a system that isn't like rigid and strict, but rather adapts to pressures that you put on it, just like a free market would be, just like your body will be when you're exercising, then you end up with a much more robust system. And I mean, how this applies to sort of like being able to remember people, this or remember like actions and deeds and information and works of art, I think it's pretty clear, right? Like we have to make it so that there is no absolute like a threshold at which you put so much pressure on something that the whole thing just breaks, that it flows like water around the pressure that you put on it, and it sort of adapts.
So, Eric, do you think that the first true AI, the first strong AI, will be will exist in a decentralized system?
I do. I definitely think that the first strong AI will not be something that is even. I think it's going to be an accident. I think it is totally going to be a number of systems that are allowed to communicate as independent parts that will just sort of naturally put pressure against one another and will adapt in their individual specialized functions. In the same way that, you know, we as humans, we're not individuals. We're this collective organism of billions and trillions of cells, right, that all have very different functions, right, that are all interacting with and communicating with each other, right? Like, the body signals other cells signal each other in your body by passing chemicals back and forth that cause very predictable reactions at the very small level. But when you take these in sum, super additivity, right, you become some, when you have so many things being added up, it becomes greater than the sum of its parts, right? Because you have sort of emergent behavior from this complex system. I mean, I imagine there's probably thousands of different types of cells in your body, if not more. I'm not a biologist, but I think that the strong AI will emerge from just the wide array of complex systems. And by that very nature, you'll have pockets of specialized systems that are all sort of exhibiting pressures against one another. There's like a theory, actually, that this has already happened, that strong AI is already out there. That strong AI is actively controlling us, right? That it is a consciousness that is beyond our understanding. That technology as a whole has already done this, and that, you know, I'm not necessarily talking about, you know, corporations that are doing this actively. I mean, certainly those are large masses of cells, but they're still just organs. Like, if you think about, you know, us as individuals being cells, right? We react to social pressures. When someone makes us upset, we perform an action. When someone, you know, gives us money, we go perform other different actions. So, but like, you think about all of these forces that we interact with on a day-to-day basis, we become individual cells in this larger organism. You know, technology becomes like the central nervous system for us to communicate. Video chat, phone calls, text messages. It's like this all is sort of a giant organism. Now the question is it conscious, right? Like, you know, if you have an outside force that acts on Earth, you know, it sort of responds as a giant organism, right? You know, the different nation states sort of react differently and sort of ebb and flow against one another. So, hey, maybe we already have strong AI. Maybe it's just beyond our grasp.
That's amazing. It's kind of mind-blowing. And, you know, Kevin Kelly actually kind of writes about this, the co-founder of Wired, the idea of the technium, that technology actually is sort of not really a conscious thing, but it almost behaves in this evolution as something that desires something. Technology desires to be extended, desires to persist. In that sense, it's much more anti-fragile, I guess, than even humans can be. And we certainly have that nailed down, but with evolution and freedom and whatnot. And it's a really interesting question: is, you know, how can we become more anti-fragile in this anti-fragility arms race against something that maybe wants to destroy us? But something I'm really interested in, the question of the AI, which I don't know if it's too considered too often, because we're always focused on destroying us, is the ethical aspect of it, is whether, you know, an AI with consciousness, with a rational element, one, will be ethical and actually will decide not to kill us because it values maybe some kind of ethical behavior, and two, has some kind of natural rights, if we want to use that kind of term. That it would actually have the right to rebel against humans trying to use it for their ends, you know, being enslaved. So it's an interesting ethical question. Do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, I wonder if, like, you know, I don't know evolutionary history or whatever, but it's funny. Like, do certain types of cells die out in evolutionary history, right? Like, if we consider humans to be just one type of cell in the organism, and there's many types of many types of people too that all act differently and have different archetypes, but they're groupable, right? You can cluster individual types. I wonder if, like, in complex organisms, there is a type of cell that just, like, dies out. It never exists again. Not in an individual's lifetime, but rather over a long span of time. So the question here is, like, well, does the greater organism replace the role that individual groups of humans fill, or do we become an essential component of this larger organism? And what does that mean for us? Like, do we just accept this fact that we're a conscious yet, you know, minor part of a larger organism? Or, I mean, and then if we rebel against it, it decides that we're cancer and starts to kill us, right? And I think that is the essence of the AI debate and the AI fear. You know, I think Stephen Hawking explicitly says, like, do not pursue strong AI, it will kill us. Right, like, maybe that's the inevitable conclusion. I don't know.
Or we just become the gallbladder.
Or we just become the useless appendix that it forgets about.
You know, I tend to take a more humanist approach, I guess, and maybe it's just my optimism or my naivete about this topic. But we always picture this idea of the AI as acting very much in our own image. And it may be for a reason that technology is very much a part of us. And obviously, Kelly, who introduced this idea of the technium, says that it's a very symbiotic relationship. That, you know, technology, no matter how far it ends up going on its own, is very much a reflection of us. And that does give me some optimism about it. But I'm going to take Eric's suggestion and start hunkering down with the coding manuals so I can defend myself in the apocalyptic future.
Yeah, there's also something sort of like transcendent about this all, right? Like, you start thinking about this idea, you know, you can code. If you can code, you can instruct a machine. And if you can instruct a machine, then you have this unique superpower that you're able to maybe even, you know, in theory, become a god by the construction of this alternative organism. Like, that, imagine if you could just simply create consciousness. Right. If you were able to build something that is self-sustaining, you have in effect created life. Something. I don't know what to call it. Do we call an AI life? Because it is it is an evolution of what we have accomplished. If it goes on and succeeds in conquering the universe without us and causes us to go extinct, you know, did we successfully, you know, carry out our impact? Is that human then? Is that the evolution of humanity? Maybe.
If you'd like to explore that thought, I highly recommend going to see the film Ex Machina. It just came out to theaters. And it really goes into the ethics of AI. It's a very interesting film.
Totally. And I think it's something that we've probably wrapped up this really, like, dense philosophical question in 30 minutes, which I think is a new record, because we know how humans are going to be leaving their impact on the world, which is probably going to be through AI. Maybe we won't be around to appreciate it, but it certainly is something that maybe will extend and do things, you know, we kind of want to do.
Today we're joined by Devin Reed and Ryan Taylor. Devin is the founder and CEO of BlockTech Group, and Ryan is the lead developer for the BlockTech Group's main project, Alexandria. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
All right, Devin, let me ask you, Project Alexandria, what exactly is it?
Really what it is it's kind of an amalgamation of two ideas for decentralized applications. One for kind of storing archives of the things that people say about the world through social media, and another is a platform for media sharing or media publishing in a way that lets the publisher connect directly with the audience and take all the middlemen out of both processes. Originally it was Archive Chain and Movie Coin, and then we kind of realized that by showing the beginnings of what Archive Chain was, where it was just kind of capturing tweets about certain subjects and stuff like that, we realized that that was only getting part of the picture, and then it needed to also grab all the things that get included in tweets, like video links and websites and stuff like that. So we switched our focus to work on the media distribution mechanism and realized that there's a great deal more excitement within that just in and of itself. So that's what we're focusing on for our first private beta in a couple of weeks, and then the public beta a few more weeks after that, is just the ability for publishers to publish any kind of media they want and monetize it however they'd like between, well, at least right now, between tipping and like what we're calling a pay-what-you-want wall, where they can say before a user gets access to the content, they have to pay something. Maybe the publisher will decide that that something is zero, so they're just saying, you don't have to pay me anything, but I'd like you to consider it before you watch it. And, of course, relying on cryptocurrencies to reduce that the cost of the transaction as much as possible to allow micropayments and distributed hash tables to share the actual content itself so that there's no servers involved in the entire process.
So, Ryan, you're the lead developer for the project. Can you tell us a little more about sort of how Alexandria works under the hood and how it's going to bring YouTube to its knees?
Yeah, sure. First of all, I'm actually the front-end developer. Joey Fischella is our main back-end developer right now. He's also the lead dev on Florencoin, which is what we're using. We're using Florencoin blockchain for publishing the metadata and the IPFS hashes that will basically be, it'll then build the front-end and populate that whole database and allow for the streaming. So we'll have completely serverless media streaming. Everything from video to audio, and we're working on book formats as well as web pages.
That's amazing. It seems like a lot of the projects kind of working on decentralization are trying to decentralize the whole web, but I like how you are starting very simple with how a lot of people use the internet, which is to watch cat videos, as you illustrate so well in your very popular beta alpha introduction video. So I'd like to ask sort of a question for both of you, and we'll start with Devin. How did you both begin working on this project, and how did sort of from there, how did the team come together?
Well, actually, Ryan Taylor introduced me to Bitcoin in 2013, and it just kind of blew my mind in a lot of different ways. And then further introduced me to Mihai and Vitalik and the guys behind Ethereum as they were getting started. And so I helped create one of the meetup groups in San Diego. And as like a topic of discussion for one of those meetup groups, I was thinking about what you could do with these smart contracts concepts, and that if you kind of made them more complex than just a single mechanism, they could become entire front-end applications that worked without any kind of a central back-end. So that just kind of over a couple of weeks, I came up with ideas for what I was describing earlier as archive chain. When I shared that with Taylor, he said, oh, wow, we need to use Alexandria. That's a great name for what you're thinking of here. So we actually named the project in that idea. And then also shared the idea behind Movie Chain, the idea of just publishing a block or a DHT link to a piece of media so that you can kind of decentralize the tracker process and remove websites from the picture entirely and be able to publish anything you'd like. Another idea for kind of how to crowdsource the development of physical goods was one I came up with called MakerChain, and that's something we'd like to see implemented into Alexandria probably a year out. It's going to take a lot of work to get there. But so at that point, we had the idea for a couple of, we're calling them distributed apps. I've kind of been convinced since then that it's a much more accurate way to call them decentralized apps. That and then some ideas for hardware projects. So I just kind of started looking. This is in early 2014. Who's interested in working on these kind of projects? And just started recruiting a team to start initially with just kind of experimentation. We did an AmoCAN ATM that anyone can build for like $500 in their garage, just to kind of test the theory that you can have open source hardware that anyone can build that can kind of be your gateway into the digital world. And then kind of in the fall of last year decided we're going to make our focus entirely Alexandria, and we started with the publishing of tweets according to certain search terms and stuff like that, as I was describing. Showed that at Inside Bitcoins in Vegas, and that was a hit. And then we're kind of inspired to go into the media publishing mechanism next.
And then, Ryan, do you have a follow-on to that?
I mean, Devin covered it pretty well. That's the whole history of how it happened. I got into Bitcoin in mid-2011 and was very quickly approached by Mihai Alisi to work with Bitcoin Magazine. So I wrote for them and was the webmaster for the first 2.5 years of the publication. Okay. Mihai was on my chat room. And then the rest, I brought Devin in and we kind of ran with our ideas.
Awesome. That's a great story. I always love hearing about how people sort of got into the space. A lot of this stuff is pretty highly technical, right? So we're starting to talk about distributed hash tables. I love how you guys are using IPFS. That's something that I'm very excited about. Originally started as Internet Persistent File System, which is a very exciting thing for me. But this reducing the complexity of this stuff down to something that your average person can understand is difficult. Ryan, can you talk a little bit about you guys' philosophy on how to approach this as a front-end developer?
Sure. Well, UX is very important to us. I think that a lot of these developing technologies, the disruptive technologies, they're focused primarily on the back-end stuff, on building a new platform. Things like Ethereum, Madesafe, Tahoe FS. They don't really have front ends, and they're hoping for people to build that for them. So we're kind of approaching it with that mentality and making it as easy and familiar to people, even though they're dealing with all this new tech. So using APIs in the back to cover everything with nice shiny graphics, really easy forms, and drag-and-drop interfaces to kind of bridge that gap between these new technologies and making it usable for people.
And I'll add that also includes stuff like obscuring the crypto as much as possible. You know, you denominate everything in fiat terms that people are more comfortable with, and they understand how much they're sending as a tip or how much it costs to publish and stuff like that. And they can actually see, oh, wow, I've never seen the ability to send 0.04 before. But to the front, that's what it looks like.
That's awesome. So a lot of this has to do with sort of engaging this highly technical community, right? So your job is to basically bridge the gap for people who don't necessarily understand the back-end crypto. But there's a lot of other really highly powered developers and engineers and designers out there who do understand the crypto and are building systems like IPFS and Ethereum, as well as many other open source projects. Can you talk a little bit about how you guys are engaging with the open source community and what that means to Alexandria?
Oh, absolutely. We want to be an active participant in it. I mean, Alexandria is in our private beta, we're going to be publishing all the APIs. In our public beta, we're going to be, you know, releasing the whole code. And we are working, like, really closely with some of those, I call them core devs, like Juan at IPFS. We met with him when we were in the Bay Area a couple of weeks ago, and we just kind of, like, jived philosophically. And the more we went down the rabbit hole of IPFS, the more we fell in love with it and just the approach he's taking. And I think some people in the community are looking at the fact that we're, you know, closed code right now and wondering, oh, does that mean that they're not going to be a real open source app with those same kind of ideals? And that's kind of unfortunate, but something we have to do so that we can feel like it's polished enough to be judged. And that's fine if people want to judge it beforehand because of where it is. We're confident that that'll be fine just because they're going to see it soon enough, and I think their hopes will be met. So we very much want to be a part of the open source community, and our approach to how exactly the group of people who are responsible for maintaining code and needing to get paid in order to do so, I think embraces it. We haven't really said too much about how we plan to do so, but we're avoiding and in every way possible any kind of central points of failure, which also means any middlemen, anyone in the middle that can take a cut. So we have to exclude that from kind of our business model, and it changes things, obviously, but we see opportunities to kind of enable the entire community working in the project, working on the project, participating in the project just by publishing and whatnot, to make it a profitable thing to participate in, and we will just be participants that kind of act as market makers in various ways so that the processes are as easy as possible and we are fulfilling as much demand as possible.
And Ryan, how would you say that open source philosophy kind of inspires your design work or kind of your approach to working on these things?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the ideologies of open source in general, which I've always held to be very close to my heart. The idea of all open information. So we're building, what we're building here is an information information sharing device application, and we really hope that it will empower that community to not only help us build Alexandria and make it as good as it can possibly be, but also to fill it with great content that they want to be distributed in their control and be able to share it with people and allow other people to then use their content on it that they get out of Alexandria. So we're actually discussing ideas of creating a collaboration space where you can use certain media that has been posted as fair use, as it were, Creative Commons, and you can form chat rooms, form meetups where you can build new things, new 3D printables, new videos, new podcasts and things, and then publish it and share it and continue to grow that community.
So that sounds really interesting. I'm sort of imagining that this is very tightly related to censorship, right? Like this idea that as you should be able to freely publish information without fear of it being restricted or limited. Is there a particular like thing that that maybe Ryan you experienced that inspired you to talk about these things? Is there a particular event of censorship that really drove your mission here?
My peer-to-peer communication tech background goes back to when I was a kid and I was running a BBS. So I would have people calling in via dial-up modem to my computer and we would be communicating that way. So when the greater internet comes around, BBS has all died out. And then to answer your question with one word, it's Napster. I got booted off Napster a couple of times, and I'm sure that a lot of other people did, and it just seemed ridiculous to me that here we had this information sharing available, and it was just getting attacked and shut down in every possible way. Of course, since then, with 9/11 and all of the surveillance and censorship that's gone on, it's just lit my fire even more.
Yeah, I have to agree. I think Napster sort of, you know, kicked off my passion for these things, and that gets me to thinking, like, do you think... maybe Devin, do you think that like music is really like a killer app for this?
Down the road, it will be. We hope an audience or a publisher will ever really go to where an audience is. So we imagine that the first audience is going to be the crypto community, the P2P community, etc. So it's going to be interesting to people who are trying to create content like. Podcasts and YouTube videos and stuff like that to speak to that audience, or kind of independent media folk who often do have to deal with having their videos deleted from YouTube, etc. That will be kind of that first base, just because right now they don't have a very effective way to monetize the work that they're doing at all. Like relying on ads is terrible. It's a bad experience for the end user, enough so that AdBlock is one of the most successful pieces of software on the internet. And as a result, it's very, very hard to monetize it, and it's getting, you know, harder and harder over time. And so we kind of think that a direct monetization model for those people who usually have to rely on ad tech that is, you know, really terribly old and no fun for anyone will be the first attraction. And then as that kind of creates an audience of people that enjoy whatever content is in it, then it becomes a little bit more attractive to independent musicians and then eventually to professional musicians and whatnot and filmmakers. But getting there, I think, requires that we make sure that the platform is not designed to just abuse copyright infringing materials in the meanwhile, so that those industries don't see it as in the kind of negative way that they see a lot of P2P technologies. Because I think there are steps that we could take so that the platform really encourages publishing whatever you've got and not publishing things that you don't own. Because anyone that still thinks that crypto is anonymous is kind of fooling themselves, and it's entirely possible for studios or record labels to follow the same footprints that they would need to with normal infringing material to come after you. And in this way, you've now published something permanently that doesn't belong to you and you're trying to monetize it. That's probably a few more laws. So we can discourage people from doing so. I'm quite certain that there will be a blockchain-based Pirate Bay. It's not what we're attempting to do. But it will be done just because this is, you know, an open source world and the idea is out there. But we think that it's a better mechanism right now to just try to take all the people that are having a hard time monetizing the hard work that they're putting forth so far and that so many people enjoy and start with there and try to work our way up to kind of the content that might be harder to break through to.
Devin, do you see this as being kind of project that a company like SoundCloud might be interested in like using the technology for? Is this something which eventually that'll be a long-term plan to kind of integrate with those?
Yeah, ideally we want to, I mean, it's a complex kind of matter of licensing in that we want this to be as open source of a license as possible, but in some ways that restricts the use of our APIs from being used by commercial entities, and we don't necessarily want to do so. We want to find some way to be able to bridge that. We're still figuring it out. It's not necessarily the priority right now, but ideally, we do want to be able to just have very simple to reach APIs that an app could reach just by talking to locally running kind of back-end databases like a blockchain or a remote one if someone so chose, that just simplified the announcing of a publisher, the publishing, how much someone wants to get paid, all the descriptive info, into very simple to use APIs so that there can be a variety of different front ends that all input into the same library. So that it can just grow as large as possible and be as decentralized as possible, and also kind of so that it can solve the problem of if you buy a song in one store, you're stuck in that store because that's where you bought the song, and if it's just a single file shared between all these different front ends and authorized by all these different front ends by the original publisher, it can kind of solve those issues and make it a lot easier to kind of move to whatever is a better platform without losing all your content.
So how exactly does Alexandria allow someone to sort of monetize their content? Is it an altcoin or is it something that's using the actual Bitcoin protocol?
Any of the above.
Any of the above. Can you expound on that?
Yeah, we basically publishers create a new account by announcing themselves with their Florin coin address, and that's primarily just because we're using Florin coin because it has 528 bytes of information with every transaction, and transaction costs are so low, we can publish, say, 2 kilobytes or so about a particular, we're calling them artifact, a piece of media that describes it so that it's very easily browsable and searchable on a front end of anyone, of any front end that's connected to the blockchain. So they have to announce that. And if someone wants to send a tip with a comment, or if they just want to comment on something, they have to do so using Florin coin because that's where we've got the availability of that that data space. But knowing that, you know, the vast majority of crypto users are using Bitcoin, not Florin coin, we're building it so that it's as easy as possible to use Bitcoin. So you can send tips directly with Bitcoin. Oh, shoot, we lost Taylor. So you can send tips directly with Bitcoin, and you can, if you want to create a comment, you can pay for it with Bitcoin. It just takes a little bit of back-end process so that it can trade it for Florin coin, get it back to you, and let you publish all kind of behind the scenes. So we're making that as easy as possible so that it's not really like a pain point for users, because I personally know the painful experience of having to learn how to trade on an altcoin exchange just so you don't lose your shirt when you're trying to buy some coins. So we're building it so that it's very easy for someone to make a quick purchase. Right now, that's the market maker for that would be the Alexandria team. We're working on a way to decentralize that so that any user can kind of make their wallet available at a particular price. They can say, well, I bought it this. I'd like to make 2% before I sell. And so that anyone that comes along with Bitcoin and wants to really quickly do something without waiting for the buy wall to kind of make its way to you on an exchange, they can do it and within 2 blocks have an instant exchange and publish really quickly. So, you know, we've obviously gotten a lot of pushback from a lot of people who are kind of Bitcoin-centric minded about, oh, you can't possibly do anything with anything other than the Bitcoin blockchain. It's got all the proof of work out there. It's got all the volume every day and whatnot. In my opinion, I think the world would be better served by a multitude of blockchains, and I think it would be hard to believe that that one blockchain could take over all of them, simply based on the existence of Ethereum and the existence of Filecoin, the coin kind of attached to IPFS, and in our belief, the existence of Florencoin, and that it has a very specific niche purpose that we think is very beneficial to this type of use. Obviously, the community is going to decide which way it's going to go. We think that projects like Alexandria can really kind of prove that an altcoin doesn't have to be just assumed to be a scam coin, as many were for a little while now. But at the same time, I'm of the belief that that kind of creates its own self-regulation. It makes people a little bit more wiser to what's up and stuff. And it also means that folks that are developing software like ours will keep an eye out for how they can kind of ease the pain of users as they're getting experienced with this for the first time, because we personally experienced the pain of that whole process. So, you know, I think only time will really tell, but that's kind of the way that we think it'll work out best. Sidechains might completely change that. Any number of things might completely change that. But our goal is to just kind of build the best platform possible, and whatever the mechanics of the back end are need to just serve that purpose. And if it means changing coins or using multiple, I mean, our plan is to use multiple coins for their niche services. When Filecoin is ready to be deployed, we plan on using it for a pay-per-bit kind of a mechanism, where you can make sure that someone is seeding and you pay them in Filecoin. So that, again, in the same way we obscure all that, we let people pay with dollars through Bitcoin on the front end, because that's what their wallet probably has, and everything else happens kind of obscured in the background to make the process as simple as possible.
So Devin, speaking of the kind of this early user experience, how basically Alexandria bringing its first users, what's your strategy for that? Who do you think your first users will be? And how do you kind of ensure the best experience for them with this new new kind of platform?
Well, I think our first kind of batch of beta users will help to inform that. We've had a list going for a little while now since we were talking about the project in its completely other form as well. So we've got about 600
list.
Excellent. We've got about 600 people or so that really want to try it, and we hope to get it into their hands in the next couple of weeks, and kind of let them tell us what their experience is, and you know who the best kind of target to go after. We've approached a couple of artists, who many people in the kind of the open sourcey community might be interested in, who have expressed interest in what the platform can kind of represent for them. Amanda Palmer wrote a book about the whole concept of give your art away and then ask the audience for their help to take care of you so you can keep doing it. And so we think that she'll be really amenable to it, and a few others. And we kind of think that just by pushing it toward the YouTube community and the podcast community, specifically in crypto and the alt news and stuff like that, we'll start getting a lot of content, start getting a lot of ambassadors, all those publishers who know that they can monetize directly in this, but also publish on YouTube in case people still use that, blah, 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 back and forth, and try to bring in more users themselves, because there are ways for them to monetize, and kind of see where it goes from there, and hope that a few larger artists are amenable to the idea and willing to try it out, and see what kind of audience that brings in of itself.
So that's a really good plan. But what's traction like today? Like, where are you guys at with sort of like your pilots? And how do you stay focused? How do you keep the ball moving as you're moving forward?
Today we've got about 4 dozen alpha users just in a private Slack channel where we kind of distribute daily builds and whatnot. We're very much in a it works one day, it doesn't work the next day, as we're trying to kind of get the feature set exactly the way we want it. We're right in the middle of switching from the mainline DHT to IPFS right now. So no actual media shows up anymore, just all the the pretty UI around it and stuff like that. So far, people are saying they love it. When they take in enough of it that it lets them kind of get the idea of permissionless publishing, they're really wowed by that. And I think the implementation is really quite pretty. We put a lot of attention into making it as attractive as possible. Our UI guy would argue that it's too gray. He thinks that's his failing, but that's okay for now. I think it's a lot more attractive than a lot of open source applications tend to be able to be. We've been able to do that, fortunately, because the core team of people have been willing to work on this, whether we had funding for them or not, and we came up with a mechanism so that they can kind of earn equity in the LLC to do so. So, you know, we've been able to raise some money from friends and family, so things move a lot faster when people can focus entirely on that, and then when that wanes, you know, people have to do their side jobs and whatnot, so it can get hard to make predictions about how long things are gonna take. There's been confusion about, like, how our crowdfund ties into whether we're going to release and stuff like that, and really it's just a matter of we're doing it, absolutely, and the speed at which we can do it is entirely dependent on how much we can focus on it, which means, you know, how we can actually pay ourselves. So, but I'm not too worried about the crowd sale. We have something in the works in the next couple of weeks that I think will change that and put us in a position to be able to focus on this full time. I think, obviously, just release of the private beta could help quite a bit, just putting it in front of a lot more eyes. But so I'm not really worried about it. It's, you know, it's been, you know, up and down throughout the year, but it's been motivating the entire time. Every time we get to a new stage of, oh my God, this works, that's just been fantastic. And whenever someone new has kind of discovered it and opened their eyes to kind of what you can do with all this technology, that's been really reassuring and fantastic.
It's really cool to hear. I know our listeners are very excited to kind of try this out, and we definitely encourage them to go sign up for the private beta.
Yes, please.
But so one fun question for you as we kind of wrap up here. Obviously, Alexandria's all about content. Music's a big part of that. What kind of music do you listen to while you're working on these projects? You, your team?
Well, Ryan's got a really fantastic record player. We were just listening to Postal Service and Bradley and Friends, a kind of living room recorded Bradley Noel album. We have pretty mixed musical tastes, from hip hop to, you know, Daft Punk to all kinds of Bob Dylan and everything else. So I couldn't really say that there's anything we don't like.
That's
which
fantastic.
Is great, because I constantly go through my Spotify library and, like, tag artists, email this guy in a year.
Yeah, you guys, so I've got a side project, just to sort of tell you that a little bit, called soundtrack.io. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a collaborative jukebox. You guys, I found it very useful when working with groups of people who have differing tastes, because mm-hmm. You can sort of vote on what plays next. So soundtrack.io, you should check that out. It'd be useful.
I will. I love that.
So, all right. So we're coming to a close here. Just sort of last question. What can we expect next? And, you know, where can we sort of, like, keep an eye out for what is coming from BlockTech and Project Alexandria?
I don't even know if it's live yet, but we will have a blog on BlockTech.com. So we do want to kind of keep people up to date. We've got a forum that we're building as well, just to kind of keep as many people in the loop about what's going on as possible. It's been hard to devote any time toward it while we've been so focused on just kind of getting it out the door. The next few steps look like what we'd like to do in the private beta, for anyone that signs up on our website, is anyone can create a publisher account, anyone can publish most media types, anything where we're kind of done with the UI on any verification checks. I'll put a blog post about how we're doing that. For, like, videos and YouTubes and podcasts and et cetera, PDFs. And they can share links with each other, and they can send tips to content creators, and they can put comments on them. Right now, it's just kind of you send a comment and the person gets it. Probably by the time we release, we'll actually have that in line so that when you're looking at a video, you can see what everyone's commented about it. We're basically just all the core functionality of this kind of a media sharing app works, and then we'll be building on. We've got a pretty extensive dev plan listed out on the site as far as those features we want to build as we've started putting in people's hands. So that should be in 3 weeks, 2 weeks or so.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us today, Devin and Ryan. You guys have both been fantastic. We want to thank everyone for joining in and listening, and thank you guys for joining us and sharing your wisdom.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Really appreciated it.
Absolutely.
Decentralized was edited and produced by Chaz Ferguson. Music written and performed by Tony Lees. You can download past episodes at decentralized.fm or on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/decentralized-podcast. And follow us on Twitter at @decentralizeall.